Welcome to the EDUCAUSE podcast. This podcast is sponsored by Moran Technology Consulting, providing management and IT consulting services to higher education institutions around the world. Visit www.morantechnology.com. I'm Jerry Bain for EDUCAUSE, and on this podcast, we feature a keynote address from the EDUCAUSE 2011 Midwest Regional Conference. Our presenter is Michael Wesch, Associate Professor of Cultural Anthropology for Kansas State University. His presentation is entitled, From Knowledgeable to Knowledge Able, Building New Learning Environments for New Media Environments.
All right, so I want to take you back to, this is 2003. I don't know if you guys remember this music video. This started to be a big hit. This is a music video from Moldova. It goes into Italy in 2004, then spreads throughout Europe, and everybody starts listening to this. They love this thing. It travels to Japan, making a global impact. In Japan, it starts to mix with anime culture, so people start making these little animations of it, and then it finds its way to a suburb in New Jersey, and this is where Gary Brolsma looks into his webcam and says, hello.
Hello.
There's this guy, this was once said that this single-handedly justifies the existence of webcams.
A video made by a teenager from New Jersey is finding itself in the email boxes everywhere, and folks, this one is the real deal.
Okay, so this starts to go viral. Obviously, it's on the Today Show. Some people have suggested it's been viewed almost 700 million times. It's one of the most viral videos of all time. And it got launched mostly because it came out just before YouTube was launched in February 2005. So Chad and Steve, and here's the first video uploaded in 2005. And then this creates a platform on which anybody can upload a video. Because when Gary Brolsma uploaded his video, he could do it because he was kind of a geek, and he knew the ins and outs of how to upload a video before YouTube. But now with YouTube, if you search Numa Numa, you get about 58,000 plus hits, and all of these are people basically just joining in the dance. So it's almost like the internet's version of the Macarena. You know, it's like all these people lining up and off they go. And when I first saw this, I thought, okay, something big is happening. Video is now entering the realm of user-generated potential. It's not just people who know how to edit a website that can get in on this. It's just anybody with a webcam can get on this. So I decided to get in on this. and then I brought my whole working group into this. This is my class at Kansas State, and we decided we really need to understand what was happening here. So you'll see a number of my students here joining in the dance as well, but also really trying to engage in YouTube and what's happening on YouTube. So we spent several years looking at YouTube and trying to understand it, and we thought, this is a whole total revolution. Something big is happening, not just in YouTube, but all over this space. And I have to say, 5 years later, I'm actually pretty disappointed. And as I look at my students, I'm really surprised at how non-literate they are in this world. It's pretty surprising. I mean, so they can entertain themselves here, but they're not very good at educating themselves here or doing anything that's really radically changing the world in the way that maybe we really thought might happen 5 and 6 years ago. And I'll just give you a quick quiz that I do with my students. So this is the students I face every year, 200 to 400 students at a time, right? And they have to be there, and so it's sort of the perfect storm for a disengaged group. And I ask them. I asked them a series of questions, just a simple vocabulary test, and I just asked them, okay, do you guys know what fair use is? This is something I think would be, basically anybody would know what fair use is if they're uploading a lot of video to the web, if they're really participating in online culture. DMCA, net neutrality, device freedom, HTML5, codec, just basic vocabulary for anybody who I would consider to be media literate. And on all of these, you get somewhere around 0% of students knowing what these things are. So that's really bad. I'd like to see that number somewhere near 100%. And in the meantime, you know, you see the class here and you think, man, that's a tough crowd. You know, they're totally disengaged. Like, and this, you know, I've been doing this for like 7 years, and I've always felt this tremendous sense, like, wow, what happened to them? You know, like, they just come in and they're just they shut down and they disengage. They start doing other things other than participating in class. And, you know, you could say it's this generation. A lot of people have these theories about, well, this is just this generation. But, you know, this is the same group here. I don't know if you can see the difference. But this is not just like a generational thing. There's something in the environment that's causing a problem here. And so then I ask, I have a little test for myself to see if I'm really engaging in the students. Because what I've realized about these students is that while they're all very diverse in where they're coming from, they all seem to be seeking meaning. And that's where maybe I'm failing in this large classroom. These students grow up in a world in which identity, recognition, and meaning are not givens. Those are things you have to actually find for yourself. It's actually, as an anthropologist, I take the long view here, like, say, a 10,000-year history. There's a pretty unique period in history in which identity and recognition are not givens, and these things have to be found, and all of us struggle through our entire lives to find identity and recognition and meaning in our lives. So that's where they're at. And my little test for myself is to simply pay attention to the questions they're asking. Because if you think about where learning starts, it starts with a good question. And once somebody has a good question, they're just off and running, and they can learn and learn and learn, and you can just get out of the way. So I started paying attention to the questions they're asking in this environment, and they tended to be questions like this. How many points is this worth? How long does this paper need to be? What do we need to know for this test? Stuff like that, right? Obviously, like, these are like blockades to learning. They're actually kind of asking you, like, how much do I need to learn? Because, you know, I'm busy. So there's other messages being sent. Here you see students buying $100 textbooks they never open. This is all confessions offered by students. Neighbor paid for class but never comes. They complete 49% of the readings assigned to them. This is a survey that we did there. And this is even more importantly, they find only 26% relevant to their life, which I think is like a 74% failure rate on our part. And then you see this, I bring the laptop to class when I'm working on class stuff. And this is actually legitimate. As she put this up, her friend messaged her here. So this is obviously a pattern. And then Facebooking through most of the classes. And this then is indicating yet, well, it's an opportunity. Everybody in this room knows this is an opportunity, not a problem, but it sort of feels like a problem in a big classroom where you're trying to lecture. And the problem is that there's literally something in the air, and the something in the air is like the, you know, roughly 2 billion people on the planet connecting and collaborating all around us, and it's actually in the air all around us, and most of us have a device with which we can tap into that environment in some way, and our students, of course, are doing it all the time. So that's what's in the air all around them. And if you could picture what that stuff in the air looks like, it might look something like this, but that's really just the beginning, and that video, I think, did a nice prelude to that. If you follow anybody who's sort of looking out for the future, where are we going to be in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, they all agree on this, that we're headed towards ubiquitous computing, ubiquitous communication, ubiquitous information, unlimited speed about everything everywhere from anywhere on all kinds of devices. And nobody disagrees with that. They disagree with how we're going to get there and what it might look like in the specifics, but nobody disagrees with this general trend. And that means that it's now possible to connect, organize, share, collect, collaborate, and publish with anybody, to anybody in the world, which makes exams like this, which we tend to be using in these large classrooms, seem especially irrelevant. And so what I'm going to suggest to you today is that we need to create environments and create campuses where students can move from being knowledgeable to being knowledge-able, that is, actually able to find, sort, analyze, criticize, and ultimately create new information and knowledge. And too many of our institutional sort of set up situations now are geared towards the knowledgeable side rather than the knowledge-able side. And we're going to think about how we can do better. So we need that knowledgeability to take place in this environment. It's not happening in this environment, so where do we go? Now, I want to first start off with what's at stake. I want to really paint a picture of how important this is. And what really drove it home for me was actually my experiences in Papua New Guinea. So I worked for off and on for about 8 years in Papua New Guinea studying the effect of new media in New Guinea. So if we fly into the center of the island here, the island just north of Australia, we fly into the middle, it takes you about about 2 weeks to 2 months to get to this airstrip, because you have to just hitch a ride on some little Cessna to get in here. And you land here and you walk for 2 days and you end up in villages like this. And these are the villages that I was spending all that time in for those 8 years. And so you walk into a village like this and there's no electricity, there's no running water, there's no 3G access, your phone doesn't work, there's no connection. And this is, it's isolated enough that most of the people in these villages have also never seen a working phone, for example, or been connected outside in any way. So this is a very isolated area, and if we just take a little tour here, you can see these are the houses that they live in. They grow all their own food, taro, sweet potato, bananas. They raise pigs, so this is like a big feast here. They're also opportunistic, so after a big rain, the rain will wash down the spiders and the eggs, and they can harvest the spiders and the eggs and eat that. Snakes are a good deal. After a snake eats, it just sits around pretty lazy-like, right? So you can usually capture the snake at that time, and then it's too for one deal because you can get what the snake just ate and you use that as the appetizer. And here you can see where they cut the appetizer out. And this snake is a very important snake because it was found just about a week after I first arrived. And I'm staying in this hut here, and the snake was found about 100 feet away, and they bring it in and we eat it and it's wonderful. It was a nice break from the taro and sweet potato and that kind of thing. But then, you know, I'm sitting around this fire here in the hut, and these are actually my legs, and that's my sleeping bag there. And I'm getting a little bit nervous because as I look around, I can see that there's holes everywhere in this hut. And my snake karma is not good since I just ate the snake. And so that night, I'm especially vigilant to wrap myself up really tight and protect myself from these elements. So I'm wrapped up in my sleeping bag, but it's the tropics. So in the middle of the night, the sleeping bag comes off of me. And that very night, I wake up and I can feel this thing across my chest. It's just laying across my chest about this big around. I can just feel it right here. And I grab it with my left hand. I throw it off of me, but as I throw it, I roll with it. So somehow I'm wrapped up in this thing, and I get it pinned down on the ground with my left hand, and I can't see anything. So I try to free my right arm so I can pin it down with two arms, but I can't move my right arm. And at this point, I finally realize that I've actually pinned down my own right arm like this. my arm had actually fallen asleep and it was across me like this. So there actually was no snake. And then I'm left trying to explain all this to them. And this all sounds very funny, but this is actually the beginning of the darkest 2 months of my life. And I realize the reason why is because, you know, like we talk about culture shock. And I think what culture shock really is it comes from the fact that you think you know who you are, but in fact, most of what you think you know who you are is actually reflected back to you from other people who know you. And when you're suddenly in an environment when nobody knows who you are or what you are, yourself isn't reflected back to you, and you feel like you're totally lost. You feel like you've lost yourself. And so that's how I felt for the next 2 months, and I had to then recreate myself. And this is the beautiful thing about being an anthropologist, I guess, is that you have to recreate yourself in a new environment, and you have to learn a whole new world. And that's what I was busy doing. And I started doing this thinking how different this is in a world without media. And then all of a sudden, new media came in. And it came in the form of writing. And it seems so simple because it came in the form of government writing. And government writing is stuff like census books and law books and stuff like that. And here comes the census book. And all they're doing here is trying to write down the names of the people in the village. And they're really struggling because a lot of the people in the village don't have a fixed name that they can give to these officers. And that's because they have totally different ideas about what identity is, and they name relationships rather than people. And so they really had to struggle with this, and eventually they invented a new word, census name. They borrowed the English word, census name, and people then had to invent these new names for this list. Pretty soon this started to have pretty dramatic effects on the village life. So the villages used to look like this, and then they started rebuilding them like this one down here, straight lines, numbered houses, and the houses are numbered to match the census book. So this book is actually sort of rewriting the way people are living. And it gets even more dramatic with the law book, for example. Law used to be like this. In fact, there was no written law. There's no law, fixed law at all. And what happens is when somebody has a dispute, they come out into the middle of the village and they start talking it out, and people try to help them fix this relationship. And then the law book comes in, and instead people are brought into a courthouse, and now they're held up as individuals to the letter of the law. So that was starting to change things as well. And I have a whole dissertation about all these changes that were happening. I won't get too far into it now, but the short version of this is just to say that media are not just tools. That's something we say all the time in IT, that media are just tools. But in fact, they're not. They're actually much more powerful than that. They're not just tools, and they're not just means of communication. They actually are what allow us to connect with other people, but they also shape how that connection happens. And so we could say that media mediate relationships. They shape what can be said, who can say it, who can hear it, how it can be said, how it will be heard, and how it will be accessed later, if it will be accessed later, by who, and so on. And you pile all those influences up, and you see why the printing press had such a dramatic effect on culture, for example, and now the web as well. And so when media change, relationships change. Now I'll give you another example here. If you just go to the television, think about how television shaped the relationships in the American family, so that suddenly you can actually see it mapped into our living rooms, where we turn all of our furniture to face the corner where the TV is. In fact, this is really the dining room for a lot of American families. So this is the remapping of the American dining room. And there was a great analysis of this by Neil Postman in the mid-80s. He pointed out that the conversations of our culture are happening on television. And they're still happening on television. It's still the dominant medium of our age. And those conversations are controlled by the few, designed for the masses. They're always entertaining, even the serious ones. So our politics devolves into sort of soundbite politics and entertainment. These conversations are punctuated by 30-second commercials, and he concludes that these conversations create our culture of irrelevance, incoherence, and impotence. And then we move on to the 90s. So that was mid-80s when he says that. Then we move on to the 90s. We get this onslaught of media. We get the MTV generation. This is my generation. This is my high school senior journal, right? And I actually used to sign my name, Mike. That looks like the MTV logo. So I'm very much a part of the MTV generation. And just to think about how media work us over, back in the MTV generation, they would say things like, the MTV generation has short attention spans because we can't last through a four-minute video. Material narcissistic, and not easily impressed. And we're not easily impressed because we live in this amazing media environment. And there's this great line about this from another anthropologist, Thomas de Zengotita. He says that in the midst of a fabulous array of historically unprecedented and utterly mind-boggling stimuli, whatever. And this actually moves us to the next phase that I want to talk about. And this is really important for IT people to consider. And that is that, you know, Marshall McLuhan used to say the medium is the message, right? That it's the form that actually matters, not just the message. And you guys, a lot of you actually create the forms through which messages travel and are exchanged. So that's a very important thing to note. And I want to take it one step further, as Marshall McLuhan did. Later, he changed it, and he said the medium is the massage. And the reason why I said that was because he wanted to point out how subtle media is. Like it sort of works you over, and it thinks you think you're doing one thing, and you think things are wonderful, and then all of a sudden you wake up and you realize, oh, it sort of massaged me into thinking that things were going well, and now things are not as I would want them to be. And I'll give you an example of this. Actually, that word whatever is a great way to track this. So consider the word whatever. My students and I decided to do a little history of the word whatever as one of these little cultural indicators that show how things have changed over time. So if, for example, you take the word whatever prior to the 1960s, and the way you do this is you just go on Google and you like bracket on Google Books, you can bracket like uses of the word whatever prior to the 1960s versus after and so on. And we found about 5 different versions of the word whatever prior to the 1960s, and they're all very typical. Things like I explain something to you, you explain it back to me, and you just use slightly different words, and so I say something like whatever, that's what I meant. And And there's lots of versions of the word whatever. There's about five different definitions that are all pretty basic like that. But by the late 60s, there's a version of the word whatever that starts to appear that has a lot of cultural heft to it. You're actually saying something pretty dramatic about yourself when you say whatever. And it's the, imagine like the hippie in the late 60s saying, yeah, whatever, man. You know, like this is like a move to say, like, I'm not part of the system. I'm disengaged from the system. And we found a great example of this in 1973. The U.S. State Department actually issued a little memo that went out. It's a little pamphlet. And in that pamphlet to returning veterans, it actually explains this word whatever and how it changed since when they left. And so this is a pretty important cultural moment. And that version of the word whatever continues to the present. So all of us can still use that. It's very commonly used among youth, especially in their sort of rebellious phases and so on. But by the 90s, there's the MTV generation, and the sort of lexicon grows. There's a new word that's emerged, and that's meh. The first version of this that we could find is from The Simpsons. This is a 1992 episode here.
Nothing you say could have said us. We're the MTV generation. We feel
like our highs
are lows.
Really? What's it like?
Okay, so that's not quite a meh, right? It was like an eh. But then right after that on, I don't know if you guys remember Melrose Place. And so on the Melrose Place message boards, so this is pre-web, right? So these are the old BBS message board things. And people were writing about Melrose Place on there, and they would transcribe this as meh, M-E-H. And so The Simpsons pick up on this, and then a later episode, you'll see it here.
With you, like to go to Blockerman! The TV gave me the impression that
he said meh, M-E-H,
meh. All right, so that's 1992. At the same time, Nirvana has the sort of rock anthem of the year, and you see the lyric here, I find it hard, it's hard to find, oh well, whatever, never mind. It pretty much captured the ethos of that era. And of course, at this time, we're deep into the medium of TV. And it's a one-way conversation. You have to be on TV to have a voice. You have to be on TV to be significant. So you have all these people struggling for meaning and significance, knowing they have to get on TV to be significant. And it was sort of the perfect storm for reality television. So reality television comes in the early 90s. It progresses throughout the 90s, basically people willing to do anything to get on TV, to get on the stage. American Idol hits its heyday. And I suppose the other little piece here that has to be explained is why, not just why all these people are so into American Idol and why they want to be on American Idol, that's easy enough to know, but why do they think that they should be the next American Idol? And if you ever watch these things, you know that most of the people in this audience think they are the next American Idol, and this is kind of a surprising thing that needs to be explained as well. So there have been some theories about this. One is just that the media environment, well, in fact, all environment, we live in such a... It's such an artificial environment, and the entire thing is made for us. Like, everything is shaped just for us. Even this room, you know, it's everything is sort of just shaped just for us. And that's very flattering. And so one of the arguments is that because we live in this highly mediated environment that's all made for us, that we are just ultimately flattered into thinking we're the center of the universe. This is Thomas de Zwingli's argument. The other argument is more sociological, and it has to do with just simply tracking the rise of the boomers through the 70s and them going through this sort of self-help phase. And you see all the self-help books emerging in the 70s, and then those are the parents now of the current generation, and so you have sort of a double dose of self-help and self-esteem, and you have the whole self-esteem movement that starts in the 80s. We move from, in the 50s, about 12% of students would agree with the statement, I'm an important student, I'm an important person, 12% in the 1950s. By the 1980s, you have over 80% of students saying, I'm an important person. That's the effect of the self-esteem movement. And one of the outcomes then is very high expectations for what they can and should be doing. So you get this American Idol phenomenon. And then you get another version of the word whatever. This is what's interesting. By the mid-90s, my students and I start to see a new version of the word whatever. And that version looks something more like this, like whatever, I'll do what I want. And it's much more like self-important. It's much more like I'm cooler than you and you don't matter. It starts with the Valley Girls of the mid-90s who would do the talk to the hand thing and say, yeah, whatever, you know, and it's the like, I'm cooler than you version. This was picked up by South Park here. This is 2002.
And now, back to more kids who are out of control. Welcome to my apartment show. Our next mother is Leanne Cartman. Her son plays the
claims to be the most out-of-control kid in the world and says there's nothing this stupid mom can do about it. Well, let's bring him out. Here's Eric Cartman.
So Jean Twenge's written about this, and she has some great statistics to back this up. She calls it Generation Me. You can see the subtitle, Why Today's Young Americans Are More Confident, Assertive, Entitled, and More Miserable Than Ever Before. And the reason why they're more miserable is because they think they're the next American Idol, and then when they're not, they're shocked. And, of course, we watch on in amusement. And what's really going on here is back to where I started this presentation, that this is really the search for identity and recognition in a society in which identity and recognition are not givens. And it's in a highly mediated environment, so they're pursuing identity and recognition through media. And at this critical moment, they hit this onslaught of media. And so Dove actually has a pretty interesting advertising campaign that tries to capture this, pointing out that these young people, as they're struggling for identity and recognition, receive this onslaught. And you can see that some of this may be quite negative in its effects. This is especially in regards to young women here. And so in education, we've always really held to critical thinking as absolutely essential, especially in this media environment. As students are just hit this onslaught of media and information, they need something to parse through it. They need some way to see through it. And so critical thinking becomes essential in this environment. But then we hit this environment, and I'm going to suggest that critical thinking isn't enough. And if you're not creating the environment in which something beyond critical thinking can flourish, then we're not doing our jobs. Because here, we need something like information literacy. I'm going to suggest you don't have to go past that. But information literacy would at least allow you to navigate this world and know where to find things and how to sort through it all. So I tried to make a video about this, which just shows the different sort of how text changed in the last 20 years since text went digital. So here's text on paper, and then you'll see here it switches to text going digital. And then I'm just going to speed it up because just through the geeky part here. the geeky part is like the difference between XML and HTML, and then it moves on here just to talk about how this unleashes all sorts of possibilities, blogging, RSS feeds, and then ultimately goes to tagging, wikis, and so on. And of course, this means that the web is not just about linking information, it's about linking people. And when you recognize that, then we need to rethink a number of things. So the video then ends with a suggestion that we may need to rethink some things. So I'd like to just think for a second what that all means, right? I mean, I think it's obvious enough why we need to rethink copyright. But we also rethink authorship in terms of our collaborations and so on. But let's think of like real world stuff, stuff that all of our students will face, and how this whole world is changing because of the web. So rethinking commerce, this is a pretty easy one actually, because commerce has been so radically transformed. But I'll take a real basic one everybody knows about. Take eBay, for example. eBay is reshaping small towns all over the U.S. simply by creating these small businesses in the middle of nowhere are suddenly international businesses. Antique shops in Kansas are international businesses. This is now transforming into Zilog. Zilog takes the eBay model, but it uses it for rentals, and it recognizes that a lot of people have a lot of stuff sitting around their house they're not using, so you can just rent it out when you want to. We have students at K-State who are making over $1,000 just by renting out extra cameras that they have sitting around. SwapTree, which is now Swap, allows you to take everything in your house or apartment, and you just document it, you upload it to the web, and then it sets up swaps for you. And so if you go on there and all you have to do is like tag like maybe 3 or 4 books, and the next thing you know, it brings up about 500,000 potential swaps that you can make, and they're totally free. All you have to do is pay the shipping to connect you with the other person. People are renting out extra rooms they have, they're renting out their cars, they're exchanging money. So about 10% of loans in the next year will be person-to-person loans rather than through a bank, and they can bypass the bank because of the web. So we're seeing the long, slow death of the middleman. You know, we saw it with travel agents 15 years ago. Now it's continuing all the way up to banks. And of course, we also have the potential to use credit cards with free devices like this, so you can accept credit cards at your next garage sale. And then you've got rethinking governance. And here I'm not just thinking about governance in the form of, say, politics. I'm not talking about politics, because we know this stuff transforms politics. But let's think about how it remakes actual governance. And that's what's happening at the Dew Tank at the New York Law School. They're actually thinking about what would happen if you were to create a society from scratch right now and not create it through paper means, but create a government that worked through digital means. And so they've set up all kinds of potential possibilities, and some of these have actually already been adopted into the U.S. and are being played around with a bit there. But imagine like wiki government, wiki lawmaking and law writing, all those things are now being explored. And so we live in this world that you might call ubiquitous, context-aware, this pretty long list here, semantic social network of things, people, and information. Start with just ubiquitous network of information. Almost everybody in this room has some way of accessing this information, and it's all around us right now. Secondly, it's not just a network of information, but it's also a network of things. So, for example, here's a little umbrella, and it's got a 486 processor in the end of it. 486 processor is about 51 cents. When I bought one in 1995, it was about $4,000. So that's how far the price has dropped. That means for 51 cents, you can put it in almost anything. And in this case, they put it in an umbrella. And it just at the end of this umbrella, there's a little LED, and it glows blue if it's going to rain. It glows green if it's not going to rain. And you can just hang it on your door, and you don't have to check the weather. You just, if it's glowing blue, you take the umbrella with you. There's a lot of smart devices that are starting to emerge that are going to be all over in our environments. But this is where things get really interesting. When you think about a network of things, you guys have seen these around, and they're not really starting to take off much in the U.S. yet. They might more so when we convert from this system to an RFID system. But basically what these are URLs. They're nothing less than URLs. They are links. And what you're seeing then is that real objects in the real world are becoming links. And once you have a link, it's now a digital object that can be commented on in the same way that anything else can be commented on online. And we're going to see an emergence of creativity and possibility around that. And of course, this is also not just linking information, it's linking people, so it's social. And that's why we're going to have to rethink all of these things as well. And to highlight that, let me take you back into YouTube history again. So let's go back to 2005 and then on to 2006. So 2005, it launches. In 2006, this is one of the first viral videos. And it doesn't actually start off as a video. This is a guy who's not really trying to make a video. He's your quintessential lonely individual of the late 20th century. He comes home to Sydney, and there's nobody at the airport to hug him. So he goes down to the mall, and he starts looking for a hug. And eventually, somebody gives him one here. And then this starts to spread. So the movement starts to spread like any good social movement, sort of person to person, and off it goes. Other people start holding the sign. More people join the hugging. And then it gets posted to YouTube, and it gets over 40 million views, and it starts to go global. So suddenly, this is a great example of how YouTube and social media started to change the game a little bit. This very localized social movement goes global very quickly. And most of these things are organized through Facebook, through different social media outlets. And you can see that there's still thousands of these happening all over the world. But of course, in this new media environment, there's one other aspect, and that's the spoof. There's always somebody talking back to the original. And these spoofs actually get pretty serious. So I don't know if you guys remember the Dove commercial I showed earlier, and you might have thought, well, that's kind of ironic that here's this beauty company actually taking a stab at beauty companies. And a lot of people haven't missed the irony there. And so Dove is actually, those commercials have actually been pretty ripe for remix, and a lot of people have been remixing them in different ways and spoofing them in different ways. And one of those spoofs is especially powerful. I want to show you here. So about 2 weeks after this was made, it had about 1 million views. And the people who made this video were invited, literally invited to the table with Unilever, who's Dove's parent company. And Unilever signed a moratorium on rainforest deforestation just within a couple weeks after this video was released. And so that shows just how powerful this stuff can be, especially if people are adept at using it. And it shows also that this is, you know, clearly not a one-way conversation. We might even question whether it's a conversation at all. And we have to move beyond information literacy. Let me, just for those of you who've never heard this term, information literacy, the old school way of thinking about information literacy is something like this. Like, you see a website, this is weforum.org, and then you notice that, you know, your students are out researching the World Economic Forum, for example. They might come here, or they might, by accident, land here, which is we-forum.org. So this is, one of these is not real, right? And the information literacy piece is, okay, how do you parse which one is which? But I'm going to suggest something else. I don't think, while this is important, the information literacy piece is important to know which is which. More importantly is the fake one here is modeling a much higher level of information literacy that I think our students should aspire to. Because if you click on any of the stuff in this page, this is a very well done fake. And if you click, for example, on the videos, here's an example of a video.
The source of our financial treasure was a violent plundering of the Southern Hemisphere. Going forward, legislation will commence to allocate some of my lands to ensure fairer, more just distribution for those victimized and to improve the livelihoods of the world's poor.
Okay, so obviously that's fake, but it was created with a sense of, like, these guys who created this thought the World Economic Forum isn't doing the job. Like, we want the World Economic Forum to address poverty in the world, and they're not doing a good enough job, so we're going to do it for them. And we're going to make our own website, and we're going to make the World Economic Forum look like it should look. And they did it with extreme media sophistication. The people who did this call themselves the Yes Men. They actually take on different corporate identities and so on and do a really great job with this. They actually get invited on CNN, BBC, and all this type of stuff by these news people who actually think that they do represent the companies that they... So here they're on TV actually representing Dow, and in this particular one, they actually made Dow's stock drop $2 billion. it came back, so... but it was a nice... It was a pretty interesting, pretty powerful statement. What these guys are doing, though, is getting to that level that I think we have to get our students to, and that is that it's not just information literacy. The next step, you might say, would be metamedia fluency. This is Gardner Campbell's term. It's basically being fluent in multiple media forms, both reading and writing. And in fact, the only way you can really be fluent in the reading of this stuff is to be fluent in the writing, because then you know all the tricks and ins and outs, and you sort of know what's happening there. And then once you're there, then it's just a short step to what Gardner Campbell calls digital citizenship. And that's what we really need to be creating on our campuses. We need digital citizenship. Citizens, because the entire world is going digital, and they need to know how to be effective citizens in that environment. And so I would say that we're actually at this critical juncture. I think we can all look at this environment and say, I think you can get this warm, fuzzy feeling like, oh, this is great, the world is changing. But in fact, we have to recognize that this could go either way. And on the one hand, you could say that we've got tremendous potential for new types of freedom, but at the same time, there's new possibilities for control and new types of control that people don't even realize. There's new possibilities for openness, and at the same time, new possibilities for surveillance that people can't see and don't know about. New possibilities for community and new ways to connect and collaborate, and yet at the same time, new ways to isolate ourselves and just disconnect altogether. We could summarize this by saying that this is a new there's new possibilities for participation. I think we can all imagine that democracies could actually be better with more engaged and more participatory citizens. But at the same time, we could see that this is a tool of mass distraction. I think if Neil Postman were still alive, the book that I was talking about earlier, where he talked about television and leading to irrelevance, incoherence, and impotence, the title of that book was Amusing Ourselves to Death. I think if he were still alive, he'd probably be writing a book right now, something like Still Amusing Ourselves to Death. Because regardless of all these great tools, they're still mostly we're just amusing ourselves and maybe not exercising all the possibilities. So what really is happening here is, of course, this is no more or less than what we make of it, and then we're here. So we live in this time of tremendous potential, and yet, you know, education is still mostly happening in these walls. If these walls could talk, what would they say? This is a video I created with my students a few years ago. It was mentioned in the intro. Debbie mentioned it there. So if students learn what they do, what are they learning sitting here? This is an old John Dewey question, basically asking, you know, essentially noting that students do learn what they do, and what they're learning at this time is that the information is up here, that they should follow along. And then you'll see here, I've invited my students here in on a Google Doc to question this system and whether or not we shouldn't try to create a different kind of system. So a lot of you have seen this, so I won't play the whole thing. The basic idea behind the video, though, is just to demonstrate the possibility of collaboration, even in large classes, and also to sort of speak back to the traditional learning environment. And here you see some of the statistics we gathered that are somewhat disheartening. So if you want to see the rest of this, if you haven't seen it, you can see it on YouTube. But again, I'm sure a lot of you have seen it, so I'm going to skip the rest of the end of it there. What we did in that exercise, and immediately following that exercise, is we decided to just get together and think about what is the message of this room. And we came up with this very quick, this is a very short summary of what we came up with. Basically, what we found that these walls are saying is that, first off, it's sending the message that to learn is to acquire information. This actually goes so deep that it's not just the students who think this. Most faculty, especially most faculty, period, and especially first-time faculty, their first question is, what textbook am I going to use? How am I going to deliver it? Those are based on the assumption that the learning is happening through a transfer of information from my head to yours. And learning is actually much deeper than that. The second assumption here is that information is scarce and hard to find. Third, that you should trust authority for good information. This is why, you know, information is scarce, so you have to come to this room to get it. You should trust authority for good information. That's the sage on the stage. Authorized information is beyond discussion, so the chairs don't turn towards one another. The students rarely talk to each other. And ultimately, you should obey the authority and follow along. And I think then, when you look at this list of assumptions, I think it's no wonder that somebody like Sean Ahmed would walk out. Sean Ahmed is a Canadian going to school in Notre Dame, getting all this information through these lectures, and really getting this sort of burning desire to do something, to change the world in some way. And he's inspired by Jeffrey Sachs, who suggests that poverty can end in our lifetimes. And so here's Sean sitting in classes and thinking, well, it's not happening here. I'm not doing anything any good here. So he decides to drop out. He withdraws from school. He moves to Bangladesh. He buys a camera and a microphone. He starts making videos about poverty in Bangladesh, posting them to YouTube. He gets almost 300,000 followers on Twitter. And he starts to rewrite how non-government organizations work, how charities work. And he's continuing to rewrite that right now. So here's a bit of that.
You guys, through your votes and video responses, will decide how I'll be spending some of this donation money.
Hey, Sean. Hey, Sean.
We donate from a very, very glad to do so.
Here is my vote. Rebuild the school.
What I see happening here, and I think what I maybe better is what I hear happening here, is some, if you listen closely to the background there, the music is actually from OP Sound, which is an open source sound project, and I think it's a great sort of metaphor, indicator of what's the best case scenario for the web. And that is to stop thinking about it as a conversation. I mean, it's a conversation in a way, but it's so much more than that. I think the best case scenario for the web is actually to think of it as a grand collaboration, not just a conversation. And in the background of that video, you could hear basically one of these grand collaborations, because what was happening there was it was Colin Mutchler had uploaded the guitar track. That's the guitar track you hear there. And then he posted to OP Sound, and so anybody can download it and remix it, use it as they want to. Cora Beth hears it. He's over in Washington. She's on the other side of the U.S. In North Carolina. She plays her violin on top of it. And then Vavrek here grabs all the beats that you hear now just started. Vavrek grabs all the beats from this resource. And this then essentially becomes a collaboration of like thousands of people around the web, around the world, using the web to create this music that you hear. And I think that's one of the great sort of metaphors for the web. I think you can hear it through music. So I want to give you one more example. This is from Eric Whitaker. He's a composer. And what he's done here is he's created a composition and then filmed himself doing the conducting here and invited people to sing along. And what I like to do when I watch this video is sort of think about, you know, these are 185 people from 12 different countries contributing to this song. And now just sort of metaphorically think of all the contributions to Wikipedia, to the web itself. All the little actions that we all do are contributing to this sort of grand choir of the web and of knowledge that we're building together. And that just layer upon layer, everything that we give to the web can make it better. And this can actually get quite serious, right? So I'll give you another example. This is from Kenya. In 2007, post-election violence erupts. And in this chaos, these four Kenyans get together and they release this product called Ushahidi. They just get together and code this thing out really quick. And Ushahidi allows people with cell phones to send in updates about what's happening where they are and then receive updates based on where they are as well. This platform, which is developed and released for free, allows 45,000 people to become citizen reporters and report what's happening on the ground in Kenya. They give away that platform. They make it free and open source so that 3 years later, when the Haiti earthquakes happen, these students at Tufts University are able to implement the same platform, call it Ushahidi Haiti, and they start getting tens of thousands and then hundreds of thousands of messages from Haiti. And these messages say things like, we are looking for Gebbie Joseph, who got buried under Royal University. They're able to map these and make sure that they're mapped properly. And then people on the ground receive these messages. They're not using Google Maps because they weren't detailed enough. They're using OpenStreetMaps, which is like a wiki map system, thousands of people contributing to it. That's the map that's used on the ground in conjunction with Ushahidi. And you can see Clark Craig here from the U.S. Marine Corps, who's on the ground there, saying it is saving lives every day. I wish I had time to document every example, but there are too many. I say with confidence there are hundreds of these kinds of success stories. The Marine Corps is using your project every second of the day to get aid and assistance to the people who need it most. I think that's the real potential of this particular moment that we're in. And the question is, are we doing it here? And I think it's not happening here just yet. So how do we change the message? And I'd like to suggest, even though this is an IT crowd, I'd like to suggest that technology alone is not the answer. And I'll show you why. You know, one of the technologies that a lot of you actually might have been involved in, if you've been around for a while, you might have been involved in this overturn, pretty big movement in the mid-90s, and it really continues to the present day, of installing these very important devices. It's represented here by that glowing bluish-green thing in the background, right? The projector. And if you think about what that projector is a pretty amazing technology. It represents 786,432 points of light, if it's a 1024 by 768. And imagine what you can do with those points of light, considering especially that these points of light are connected to, you know, about 2 billion people connecting online and so on. It's a pretty remarkable thing what might be done with those points of light. But of course, what most professors decided to do once they had those points of light in their hands is do PowerPoint. And PowerPoint helps the presenter remember their notes while often doing great harm to the presentation. And if you really think about, you know, that John Dewey question of like, you know, students learn what they do, what are they learning when they're watching PowerPoint, you recognize that PowerPoint encourages students to memorize key points, to let the professor decide which points should be key, and to regurgitate these key points on exams. There's no shortage of examples of people who come to me after I say something like this and say, I know somebody who just, you know, basically they were great before PowerPoint and then they became the worst teachers ever, you know. And so you could suggest, actually, that PowerPoint is great for teachers. That is, it's great for, it makes our lives convenient. And if you're really into teaching, like sort of dumping information on people, that's a great thing, too. But it's pretty bad for learners. It's bad for learning. There's this great quote here from Edward Tufte. Power corrupts, PowerPoint corrupts, absolutely. So there's actually, this is actually a long time battle. This is a great quote I wanted to bring up. Call up in imagination the ordinary schoolroom, its time schedule, schemes of classification, of examination, of promotion, or rules of order. The very situation forbids active participation. That which is taught is thought of as essentially static, used as educational food in a society where change is the rule, not the exception. This is John Dewey, 1938, and he's actually reflecting on decades of debate in education. So this debate that I'm bringing to the floor now has been going on for over 100 years. Just go back to Sputnik, 1957. It was sort of reinvigorated at this moment because the Russians are beating us. We decide we need to call all these educators together. We call all these educators together along with a number of scientists. And the people who get them together think that what can happen is the scientists can just give the educators a list of things that people need to learn to be successful in this world, and then we'll be fine. And instead, what the scientists said was, I can't give you a list because it's going to be different by the time they graduate. Instead, you need to teach them how to think. And that was not what they wanted to hear, but that's what happened. And so Jerome Bruner wrote about this in 1962. He came out with the process of education. We started to move from sort of content orientation to process orientation, but that really didn't go far enough for some people. So by 64, John Holt was writing How Children Fail. By the late 60s, we had several sort of subversive texts, such as Teaching as a Subversive Activity, Pedagogy of the Oppressed, Death at an Early Age. What these texts are saying is that you can focus on process all you want, but so long as we're creating an institution in which people are lining up in 400-seat lecture halls to listen to the sage on the stage, it's not going to happen. So they were asking this question: if students learn what they do, what are they learning sitting here? It was summarized really nicely as like this. In the late 60s, they ripped into the curriculum, the regimentation, the industrial mentality, the grading system, standardized tests, school bureaucracy, homogeneous grouping, and all the other assumptions and conventions which gave the classroom its peculiar character. This sounds so familiar, right? Because we hear it all the time today. This is from this is talking about the late 60s, and this is Neil Postman in 1977 talking about this. So where do we go from here? I would suggest that the only thing different about the argument now, it's been going on for over 100 years, is this. We live in a new, different environment. And we could go one of two directions here. We can either use this environment to connect, collaborate, and contribute together, and to draw on the theme of the conference today, or this environment is also really good at creating disconnections, disengagement, and distraction. Think about the worst online course that goes on at your campus where a professor has basically just set it up on autopilot and students are reading through materials on their own and they don't never connect with anybody, and then they take an online exam and the professor cashes their paycheck. This is happening all over the U.S. It's the worst case scenario for this online environment. But there's a lot of examples of the best case scenario as well, and I want to show you how those best case scenarios happen and what you can do to help them happen. And I would suggest they happen in this way. We move from being knowledgeable to knowledge able by recognizing that knowledgeability is a practice. And so you have to set up environments where knowledgeability is practiced. And the way to do that is you just set up a place where students and faculty start with a real and relevant problem, like something that's real to the world and relevant to the students. Then you get the students to work together, and you can use various collaboration platforms and so on to do this. And it's the third aspect, then, is the technology, which is that technology which allows them to connect and then contribute to these real-world problems. So I'll give you some examples from my classes. So here's a small class, and you'll see here in a syllabus, instead of a syllabus, we actually created a research schedule, and any student can edit this at any time. And the reason why is because we started out with, we all know that we want to solve this big problem, we're going to work on this problem together, and so anybody can edit this knowing that, as research progresses, you might need to add something here or there, so students can add something to the syllabus, and then everybody's alerted to it, and they can go back and they can debate the merits of that change. Here's a reading assignment. Instead of the standard reading assignments in classes, where a faculty member, the teacher assigns a reading and then everybody comes back and talks about this one reading, what we do is we are working on this big project together. We want to solve some real-world problem. So the students go to the library, and they scour the library for resources on this topic. And they start summarizing everything that they see. So here is, this is using Etherpad. You can do it on Google Docs as well. And students are just summarizing everything that they read, and then they read each other's summaries. And so, just as an example, after the first week of class, my students will come back, and on average, we will have read something like 90 articles. Collectively, we've read 90 articles. So instead of one article being up for discussion, we've got 90 articles, and each student in the room is an expert on, say, 2, 3, maybe even 5 or 6 of those articles, because they're the ones who summarize them. It's a very different type of environment being created through that. Students are blogging openly. So here's a student of mine from last year blogging openly. He's blogging his literature review. And by blogging it publicly, a great thing happens. One of the key people he mentions in his review, which is a professor at Columbia University, writes him back and says, you know, you should also include this in your lit review. You should look at these resources. So by doing this openly, you know, you're connecting out with the broader world. And then my students also create videos of their work. Here they created each student, there's 12 students, they each create a 5-minute video. We put all of those together and it becomes basically a documentary, a 50-minute documentary. And you can see we get lots of views for these things, reviewed in the New York Times, much better than, you know, doing a blue book exam that gets thrown into the hopper at the end of the year. In the big class, we break up the classroom, recognizing that each one of us has something to contribute. Each student becomes kind of like they become an expert in a different part of the world. So this is anthropology, right? So it's the study of all time, all humans in all times and all places. Really big topic. But each of the students becomes empowered to knowing that they're the ones who know about this one particular part of the world, this one piece of world history, and so on. And then we get them all together and we try to simulate world history. Let me show you what this looks like. This is real. This is a real class. It will look totally crazy. So I just want to preface that this is real. So the students have now, they've studied the world, and what they've done now is they've created their own sort of alternative world to model world history. And what they're trying to do is model world history of the last 600 years. And you can see they've created all kinds of different ways to do this. The students are filming this on 20 different cameras and then editing it. So you're seeing the edited version here, and it's a 20-minute video sped up to be about 3 minutes long. So excuse the rapidness of the video. But you can see here they created a system for colonization. So some students are going out to colonize, modeling early colonization from 1400s to the 1700s and then on to the 1900s. Here you can see students had created a system of the Fruit Loops represent sort of natural resources, and those are being exchanged and manipulated in different ways. Here you can see some students finally they're starting to gain independence. So this represents various independent movements starting in the 1700s and then on to the 1900s. And the students, in order to do this, had to create their own rule systems for this game. And in trying to figure out how to create rules for how the world works, they, of course, had to learn a whole lot about how the world works. They started finding theories. Here you see Wallerstein's world systems theory being used. That's a theory that I never encountered until graduate school. Here we had freshmen picking up on this theory, just trying to work it into the game because they're so excited about how to figure out how to make this game and then how to understand what happened during the game as well. So here you see we're moving into the actual conclusion. You see up at the top, I just mentioned there's the Twitter feed. Students can send up updates anytime through the Twitter feed at the top. Now this is the actual conclusion to the class, or to this class period, I should say. I'll let you watch it here. The beauty of this, if we go back to that original sort of test that I have for myself, you know, students stop asking, what do we need to know for this test, you know, the sort of Scantron test, and they start asking, what do we need to know for this test, the test of our lives? And I would say one last thing I want to say is, you know, we talked about this word whatever and how it's changing over time. My hope is that we move from this sort of 1960s version of sort of whatever, you know, I don't care, that kind of thing, and past the 90s version of the whatever, I don't care what you think kind of thing, and we move into a new era where maybe we can create environments in which our students start saying, I care, let's do whatever it takes by whatever means necessary. Thanks.
Michael Wesch from the 2011 EDUCAUSE Midwest Regional Conference. This podcast is sponsored by Moran Technology Consulting. I'm Jerry Bain for EDUCAUSE. Thanks for listening.